This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Vanity Fair.
Hello and welcome to Little Gold Men, the award season podcast from Vanity Fair.
I am delighted and proud to introduce him as Academy Award winner.
And the Oscar goes to...
And the Oscar goes to...
The winner, it's a tie.
And any little girl who's practicing their speech on the telly, you never know.
Mom, I just want an Oscar.
I am Katie Rich. I'm here for today's interview episode with David Canfield.
Hello.
And with Rebecca Ford.
Hi.
Hollywood is very much heading into the holidays, which I think makes it a great time to talk to some stars from movies that people may need to catch up on in the coming weeks. So we're going to start with you, David, and your conversation with Juliette Binoche, who is in a film that premiered at Cannes under a different title, is now being released as The Taste of Things. And it's one of those movies that might not have been on people's radars. They didn't know what to make of it. It's a French drama, or sorry, a French light comedy, you'll have to tell me. But everyone who sees it walks out being like, wow, I loved this. Like, I really loved this. And I think Juliette Binoche has been right at the center of some of those raves.
Yeah, the movie has snuck up on pretty much everybody I know. And that's the big reason why is it's got a ton of heart. And I think that when you hear a movie about French cooking in the description, it kind of delivers on exactly what you want, which is this unbelievable degree of food porn, but thrown in with this unbelievably tender romance between Juliette Binoche's character Eugenie, who is a cook, and this restaurateur that she works for, Dodan, played by Benoît Méchamel. And they have unreal chemistry. The sensuality of the food being cooked around them just adds to the atmosphere. They filmed in a castle in the Loire Valley. I don't know what else you could ask for.
Well, David, you say they have unreal chemistry, but I think they have real chemistry because they know each other and have known each other in real life.
Yeah, they used to be a couple. They share a child. They had not worked together in a very long time. And we talk about that. Juliette, of course, an Oscar winner who has made a lot of very demanding, particularly European movies over the years, I think was uniquely nervous about walking into a project that would demand a really particular kind of emotional vulnerability. And then there's also just the practical question of, like, how will being in love with this character feel, you know, given their history? But she describes it in really therapeutic terms, the actual experience of filming with him, and particularly really credits their history with what they bring to the movie as a unit.
You know, this might sound gossipy of me, but I just think any actor exes who are on good terms should have to do this. Like, it is such a fascinating thing to imagine watching play out on screen. So I hope they start a trend here.
I very much agree. And I think anyone who sees the movie will join our bandwagon.
Yeah. Well, let's hear more about that in your conversation with the star of The Taste of Things, Juliette Binoche.
Juliette Binoche, you're here to speak about The Taste of Things, France's selection to submit for the Oscars this year, and a really wonderful film. To start, can you tell us a little bit about how you got involved in this movie?
I knew the director a little bit because, first of all, I saw his films mm-hmm. and loved his work. And he came to see me when I was shooting a Hao Shaoxian film, a Taiwanese director's mm-hmm. film in Paris. And so he came and we spoke a little bit, and there was a softness in him. There was a way of, you know, his presence was special to me. It was very soft mind, and, you know, so I liked his presence. And I think it's choosing a film has to do with that, because the director's going to be the one looking at you, listening to you while you acting, and then making the decisions at the end for the editing. So I thought I'd like to be seen and heard by him.
Yeah. He does make a beautiful romantic movie here, and romantic in many senses of the word, I think. As you got to talking about your role in the film and this relationship at the center of it, what appealed to you and what were you most excited to play within that?
Well, the relationship to food is, of course, it reminds you of the relationship with your mother, of course.
Yes, absolutely.
Because that's the first, you know, breastfeeding moment. And the need of being fed stays forever.
Yes, it does.
You never get over it.
It is timeless.
But also the need of love and the need of being taken care of. And then, of course, there's a moment it reverses, because when you have kids, you have to take care of, you have to cook, you have. So there's something essential about, you know, this film in a way, because it's about food and preparing for others. But also, I like the analogy between the relationship between Doda, who's the being played by Benoît Magimel, and myself, because it reminds me of the relationship between a director and an actor. Mm. You know, that is the conceptor. He has the idea of the recipe. And my character is a cook who's going to make it real, who's going to incarnate this idea. And it's very much what actors do, is that we have to, you know, read lines on a paper that's been thought about before, and then we have to make it real and alive and truthful and vibrant. So I think that's what she does with the cooking. But you know, while I was cooking, I didn't think too much of cooking. I felt more of a painting process or a sculpting process. Mm-hmm. There's something quite artistic, and we call it in France art culinaire, culinary art, mm-hmm. because it lifts the matter into something special.
Yes.
And so I like the story, and I like the challenge of it, because cooking with others in an ancient world, which is 100 years ago, even more, it was interesting, because the director, whom was very picky about being historically correct with the time in the way of choosing the meals, the dishes, but also all the silverware and everything, all the details of a table. He wanted to be really accurate.
The film begins in this really stunning sequence of cooking with you, and it is both very salivating and mouth-watering, but really artistic, as you were saying, and very, I found it even moving. Going into that scene as an example, like, how did you find the movements and the flows of these cooking scenes?
Hung, the director, was always asking me to keep smiling. Mm-hmm. It's been always happy. But of course, knowing that I had to play this character, I knew it was a little more complex than that. So, because yes, she's hiding a lot of things behind. But no, I mean, together, what we did is we had to make sure that in the pace of it, we would respect everybody's, you know, pace for the right cooking, the camera. So there was a sort of a ballet thing that you have to do in mm-hmm. sequences. So there was not a big change compared to what I've done before. And because sequences are exciting, because you have the real pace, but at the same time, that's why we rehearse quite a lot. You know, mm-hmm. we had a day of rehearsals before we did that shot. So, but it was not that much of a problem.
Given the gastronomic specificity, let's say, of the film, did you have a level of confidence in being able to act out making some of these dishes? Or I suppose, what's your level of cooking versus what the film required?
I don't think I had any difficulty in learning, you know, the recipes. But there are some gestures the cooking gestures you do, you know, in like cutting or doing the savaillon, a special sauce, you have to move a certain way, like eight, mm-hmm. doing the eight, but very, very quickly. So it becomes like it's like playing music, really.
Mm-hmm.
And that I couldn't do very well. Some moments I could do, but it would have meant, you know, being an apprentice for about 3 years, which I didn't yes. have the time to do. And anyway, Wung was not interested in seeing the obvious gesture of the actor cutting, you know, very fast, yes. People do in kitchens. So, no, we didn't need that because it wasn't the purpose. And also it was specific to 1886 way of cooking. Also,
yes.
There was not much of that, question.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm curious how you found the perspective of the film. I spoke with your director, Hung, a little bit about it, and he described it as a kind of love letter to France, his love letter. And he's somebody who came to France at a young age and who has a real affection for it culturally in all aspects. And there is a kind of dreamy aspect to the film in that regard, especially for me as an American journalist. I'm curious how you found it.
It's true. He really embraced the French culture.
Yeah.
Through cooking, but also loving, mm-hmm. you know, this area, the seasons. You know, we really have four seasons. Really cold, can be very hot. And all the this softness that you can feel also in that area of the west part of France called Anjou, L'Anjou.
Mm-hmm.
And also literature. He embraced the literature of French way of measure, softness, ordered, you know, kind of way of writing or expressing oneself. So I see that, and I'm very touched by it because, you know, he came to France when he was only 8 years old, and
mm-hmm.
and it was probably not easy for him to adapt into another language, another way of doing things, and he was probably bullied at school, and how he, even though, you know, was embraced, you know, the beauty of French culture.
Yes. It's funny hearing you say that he was encouraging you to smile. And I think there is a real light around your character in this film throughout. And it was interesting for me as a fan of your work, and particularly a lot of the characters you've been playing lately have a complexity, let's say, and an intensity. Did this feel like a kind of a different key for you to play in from what you've been doing, at least of late?
It's very hard to know in advance how you're going to be playing something.
Yes.
It's really when you're in the spot and dealing with the other actors and feeling how the director's, you know, pace, how much he allows you to go further into the, you know, the takes you're doing. So it's always interesting how you have to adapt yourself. Knowing that my character was close to death,
mm-hmm.
always, and denying it or wanted to hide it, not to hurt. It was always interesting because there was almost a contradiction with wanted to give life, wanted yep. to give pleasure, wanted to work as much as she did, the exhaustion of it. And at the same time, knowing that it was the end soon. So it was very moving, actually, to play that role. And the softness, the long-lasting relationship that... Mm-hmm. I didn't play very much in films because that's not a theme that a lot of directors
right.
want to explore, because that's you're more into conflicts, you're more into battles or into the first love, you know, the first encounter or the end of a relationship, and rarely a long-lasting conjugality of a relationship. So that was good for a change. I like that.
Yeah, it's hard to get it right, too, even beyond the limited amount that you see a kind of relationship like that in a film. You have to have that sense of history and that sense of familiarity that I think comes across in the film so beautifully.
I'm Alex Schwartz.
I'm Nomi Fry.
I'm Vincent Cunningham, and this is Critics at Large, a New Yorker podcast for the culturally curious.
Each week, we're going to talk about a big idea that's showing up across the cultural landscape, and we'll trace it through all the mediums we love. Books, movies, television, music, art.
And I always want to talk about celebrity gossip, too.
Of course.
What are you guys excited to cover in the next few months?
There's a new translation of the Iliad that's coming out, Emily Wilson. Really excited to see whether I can read the Iliad again, whether I'm that literate. I mean, the jury is out.
I can't wait to hear Adam Driver go again in an Italian accent in Michael Mann's Ferrari.
He can't stop.
I mean, and bless him. I can't wait.
Molto bene.
Molto bene.
We hope you'll join us for new episodes each Thursday. Follow Critics at Large today, wherever you get podcasts.
You really don't want to miss this.
Don't.
Don't miss this.
Don't miss it.
See you soon.
In terms of working with Benoit, who I know you have your own history with, did you find that was a big part of it? Because there is such a level of intimacy between these characters.
Yes, of course, because that's the gift of this film in a way, is that Benoit and I knew each other. And because there was a lot of non-said things from the past, because we have a daughter together, we separated and it was not always easy. So being able to actually go into another level with mm-hmm. him and express each other's love, because they have this relationship, this love relationship that seems to be so smooth and you know, there's a softness, even though she's resisting him in a way because she doesn't want to get married, but it was very moving to be able to reconcile in that way. And also to give that film to my daughter, to our daughter.
Yeah.
It was a big gift that life gave us, I think.
Yeah. And I think especially what we were saying earlier about the tone of the film is there's something very moving about that, I think.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah, it comes across, I think it was beyond ourselves in a way. But I was very moved to be in front of him and having to, you know, to express what Hoon wrote. Because it wasn't my words. It was mm-hmm. the director's words. And in that way, I didn't feel guilty.
There you go.
Well, it was not, you know, it's so hard to express what you're feeling when there's been oceans of non-said or time, you know, of, so it's finally good to find ways to say simple things, because at the end of the day, what remains is love. There's nothing else.
Mm-hmm.
And I think if you, at the end, if it's not love, then you failed, you know, that the real failure is not the separation. The failure is the feelings of hate or the feelings of anger or the feelings that keeps you a prisoner. Mm-hmm. But when you're able to transform it into something free, which is love to me, it's wonderful. Mm. And I totally respect his life. You know, he's married and I'm happy the way I live. And so it's not about that. It's about beyond there's love. That's all I can say, especially when you have children, because it's almost a responsibility.
Yes.
To find a way to love each other when you have children, because that's they've got to learn that that's the most important.
Yeah, absolutely. In terms of working with Hung on a film like this, and you've worked with so many incredible directors, is there anything about him that struck you as really unique in terms of process or the way he works with actors that you'll take away from the film?
I love the way he is concentrated on set. He's picky about things, you know, definitely, like his wife, who's was the artistic director and costume designer.
Mm.
They work together very closely. But I love the way he is putting his camera in a loving way. I mean, it's as simple as that, in a poetic way. He's thinking director, he's thinking editing, he's thinking, you know, storytelling, how to use the camera. So it's not a habit of how well he's doing things. Mm-hmm. It's a how do I put my camera to tell the story the best I can? It's really what it is. And then and there's an emotion that comes with that. Mm-hmm. And when I come on the set and the camera is already settled, whether I was here before, it depends on the scene and whether I have to get ready meanwhile or what. But there's a connection then, you know. When I say picky, because every single glass or silverware mm-hmm. or flower, there was almost a discussion of every single
right.
detail between his wife and him. So I had to be patient sometimes because, you know, it was supposed to be my plate. It was supposed to be my glass sure. and it became their plate. It became their glasses, you know. But that was interesting because I had to learn to, okay, I have to let it go there because it's really important for them. So patience is part of the game and it goes with the film because there's a pace that goes with the film that is about being slow, sitting back and living life in a different way, mm-hmm. observing things in different ways. You know, the time of tasting, the time of smelling, the time of looking, of observing life and what's around you. That's very special to that film. But what to define Hung is that he seems very fragile like that. And he is in a way because physically he's has a cold or he has, you know, there's always going on, something going on with him physically mm-hmm. Or headache or something like that. But when he says action,
yeah,
it's very loud and it's very present. Mm-hmm. So, you know, like, oh, okay, he's saying action like that. It's important to him.
Mm-hmm.
And of course it is to me because it needs to be rooted in a place that is, you know, special, that is related to the need of making this film, the need of saying those lines, the need of expressing through emotions or, you know, whatever's going through.
Mm. I'm curious how that slowness that you talk about matches with your style as an actor. It's a kind of a broad question, but how did you find that aligned with the way you like to, you know, work through a take or anything like that?
Well, I learned that because the first shot being, you know, this long cinematic flow of way of filming the food cooking and the different temperatures, different times, timing and all. So I had to understand that, okay, he's using his camera like as a brush and he needs time here, he needs time there. So I knew I was going into a place that it was different. Mm-hmm. You know, and follow his pace, follow what he wanted. But yet, in the acting, you're being revealed by in acting. So it has its own pace. Emotion has its own pace, and you just open yourself, and it comes through you. So it's, I know once, a couple of times he came to me, and he asked me, kneeling down actually, and said to me, can you play neutral?
Hmm.
And I said, what do you mean neutral? And he said, well, with that intention, without acting. I said, no, I can't. I'm an actress. I'm feeling. I cannot be nothing. Or if I'm nothing, it needs to be specific.
Mm-hmm.
So he was a little taken aback. Also, because it was my way also to resist a little bit of what he's done in Eternity, another film he's made.
Sure.
Where the actors, the actresses were not expressing emotions that much.
Mm.
And when I, even though I found it very interesting, this film, and I was, you know, fascinated by the feeling of you have at the end of it.
Yep.
But I was a little annoyed by the not feeling of some of the actors.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I thought if I'm going to be working with him, with Hung, I'll give as much feelings as I can. So when he came to me, it was like in me, I'm not doing the same thing as Eternity. No
right.
way. Because I'm bringing into your world the emotions that I want you to be surprised by.
Mm.
And it's interesting because I mean, the relationship, it's very much like what's happening between you know, Dodin's character.
I was Dodin's going to say, yes.
and me as a cook, is that it needs to have resistance between mm-hmm. them in order to lift yourself into another place, into a place, an even higher place of art.
Yep.
And you can, of course, admire each other, respect each other, but you have to resist a little bit too, I think.
To me, that's the magic of great filmmaking, is you have artists with their own temperaments and perspectives coming together and making something together. So that should happen, right?
Yeah, it should happen. You're right.
Yeah. I know you're in Los Angeles right now, and this film is getting an Oscar campaign. And I'm just curious, you've done this a few times now, let's say, of course, how you experience taking a movie like this around and getting to share it and talk about it with so many different kinds of people, people from different backgrounds. A movie like this, especially because it is, as we say, a real love letter in a lot of ways.
Mm-hmm. In life, I don't think you can force anything.
Yes.
It will doesn't work in that way. Life doesn't work with will in mm-hmm. that way. And I learned that because I was a very willingful girl. Mm-hmm. And I had to learn, and I learned at 18 years old with a acting teacher who broke me, literally stopped me wanting. And I that's how I reached the feeling of being and more than acting, you know, mm-hmm. proving that I was an actress. So, and I feel very much that this film has its own life. Mm-hmm. And the enthusiasm that I can feel here and in other places, it's beyond my comprehension, because it's, I've done other films where, you know, it was very interesting and mm-hmm. The acting was interesting as well and all, and was not taking as it is for this one. This one has a little magic, and I can't explain why. It's the way it is. You have to just go with the flow. That is not your will. I didn't anticipate that at all.
Hmm.
And I feel like it's a gift, you know. We're all very surprised and loving the experience, because it's wonderful to feel loved, to feel, you know, embraced.
Yes.
Also, this film shows an old way of living, an ancient way of living that we lost in a lot of places, you know. I'm thinking especially in cities, because we want to do so much, you know, we want to achieve so much and forget about living, forget about our senses, very subtle.
Mm-hmm.
And we are like brutal with those senses. So this film allows to go back to a place that we can all have. Of course, you expect that when you're older and retired and we have time and all that, but it's a little sad, because you could have that a little more in your life. It made me reflect a lot about my life, this film, I have to say.
Mm.
And that's why I bought a countryside house a year ago after this film, I think.
Oh, wow.
And I really wanted to have a big kitchen like that. Because, you know, when you have a nice kitchen, you want to cook.
Yeah.
Yeah, because it's home. It's warm. It's where it burns. It's where you gather. You're uniting each other again, and it's special.
The pacing of that film is interesting in regards to what you're talking about, because I associate you with someone who works a lot. You know, you often most of the time have multiple movies out in a given year, and this film is about life taking its time.
Well, wait a little more. You'll see more coming.
Fair enough.
But I'm not being guilty working that much, because I have passion for what I do.
Yeah.
But I think I should take care a little more about, you know, my health in a way, because you give, you know, your emotions is really burning in you. You're really living different lives through acting. And mm-hmm. so it's wonderful, but at the same time, it's very demanding.
Mm.
But there's some kind of rewarding when you're giving. Yes. Because it's you feel alive. You feel that's why you're here, that you were born to do that. So it gives purpose. It gives a sort of it's okay. You're doing what you're supposed to be. There's a tap on the shoulder a little bit.
Yes. Well, in the spirit of reflecting, as you say, I wonder if you could indulge me a little bit to close. This is an awards podcast, and you are an Oscar winner. It's quite a few years ago, but I'm curious how you reflect on that moment that you won for The English Patient. I remember you seemed very, very surprised, even by the standards of winning an Oscar. Yeah, what does it feel like now to think back to that moment?
Well, a little melancholic because Anthony Minghella died.
Yes.
You know, history changed quite a lot. Harvey Weinstein is not around anymore, and he was the producer mm-hmm. of that film. And I love the actors I was working with on The English Patient, and so it's I'm missing them in a way as well. And I'm not staying in the same hotel. I'm not back home.
Yes, there you go.
No, I mean, it's like, you know, I said when I got the Oscar, I said, this must be a dream.
I remember.
Now, it feels to me the same, actually. It must be a dream again, because doing what we're doing as actors, traveling and talking about, you know, having so many demands on doing interviews, and then it's an interesting feeling because you do, when I'm acting, it's so internal, and then it becomes afterwards so external because the needs outside are so big.
So public, yeah.
Yeah, you really have to come out. Mm-hmm. And so the experience is quite fairy tale like. So I have the same feeling, but it's been done with a lot of love. That's the common denominator from The English Patient, that was full of love. I feel that this film also has this quality of even though it was the same thing, English Patient, before we started doing it, if I remember well, the Fox retrieved themselves like 2 weeks before shooting. Mm-hmm. And Miramax came to save it.
Yes, that's right.
And here, this film, this little film, we almost didn't do it. So it adds to the fairy tale kind of feeling that, you know, it almost was not made and we made it. So I'm here to embrace whatever is happening, and that's the joy of it, you know.
Yes.
Let life do its work.
Okay, Rebecca, now let's hear your conversation with Carrie Mulligan, the star of Maestro. She is truly the star of Maestro, which I think before we had seen the movie, we're like, oh, it's a Leonard Bernstein biopic. Bradley Cooper is starring and directing. He's going to be the center of the whole thing. But when you and David both saw the movie fairly early, you were like, no, this is really a movie about her, which is kind of a fascinating twist and something that Carrie Mulligan, I think, is really uniquely suited to carrying something like that on her shoulders. So I imagine you guys talked about that.
Yeah, we talked a lot about how Bradley pitched it to her. You know, he has said he had her in mind for this role from the beginning. And even she admits, you know, that she was a little worried maybe this was going to be just one of those wife of a famous artist situations. But once she read the script, she quickly realized that Felicia Montenegro was going to be front and center, which we've seen from in everything from the posters and promotional material to the actual film.
I mean, the challenges of this role are kind of myriad. There's old age makeup. There's like huge performances. There's like being part of this like musical theater world. But did she identify any one particular challenge that stood out there?
Well, it's really interesting. I don't think I've had this happen in an interview before, but she said this was like the first role where she ever really like went for it as like an actor. Like she'd always felt a little silly doing like dream exercises and all that sort of stuff, you know, with her co-star ahead of time. And she said she just really committed this time and it sort of like has forever changed her. So it sounds like this was a very, very significant project for her.
Yeah, I really can't wait to hear more about how that really remarkable performance came together. Let's hear your conversation with the star of Maestro, Carrie Mulligan.
So so excited to welcome Carey Mulligan to the podcast to talk about Maestro. Thank you for being with me.
Thanks for having me.
So from what I understand, you're out and about doing Q&As for the film now. So what does that feel like to finally, you know, watch an audience watch it and get feedback out in the world?
I just did my first Q&A for a paying audience, because we've been doing Q&As for like guilds and, mm-hmm. you know, this is the first time that someone's actually spent their hard-earned money to come and see it. So I was really nervous, but it was lovely. It was a really lovely, it was 11 o'clock in the morning, the screening started. And it was packed. So that was exciting. But I love going to see a film in the middle of the day. So that makes a lot of sense to me.
Fun. I saw this film a while ago, and I'm so excited that it's finally getting out there to audiences. From what I understand, Bradley has said he knew he wanted it to be you to play Leonard Bernstein's wife, Felicia. So I'm curious how he first reached out to you and what his sort of pitch to you was about this.
Yeah, so we've sort of known each other a little bit through, you know, work, and we bumped into each other at things, and he'd seen me in a couple of plays. And always been really lovely about that stuff. And so he came to see a play that I was doing in New York. I was doing a one-woman show called Girls and Boys in 2018. And he came to see the first preview of that. And then we met not long after that. And that's when he sort of first suggested. But there was no script or anything. It was just he was making a film about Leonard Bernstein, but also crucially about Felicia, about the two of them, about a marriage. That was clear from the beginning, that it wasn't going to be sort of the wife to the great man part that, mm-hmm. you know, we love to see. So it was, that. And he showed me Candide, the overture from Candide. We watched that. Not the overture. He showed me Make Our Garden Grow, which, okay. and that was sort of set the tone a little bit for what it was going to be like.
It's interesting because even walking into this film, I wasn't... I always hope that the wife role is a meaty, interesting role, but I've seen enough movies to know it won't always be that way. So when you did see the script, what did you sort of realize about what the story is that they wanted to tell?
I think he was really clear. It was about a marriage. It wasn't a biopic, you know. I mean, it was the music was the sort of power of the film, that, you know, there was this incredible setting for this story to unfold in, but it wasn't going to be, and then he did West Side Story, and then he did Candide, and then he did On the Town. You know, it was going to be about the choices he made in his life, both artistically, but also within his relationships. And he said, actually, early on, you know, when people talked about Lenny, they didn't talk about Lenny, they talked about Lenny and Felicia. So they were always talked about as a pair. And so when I read it, it tracked with everything we talked about, that it was going to be really about them both as artists. Because it's really also, you know, it what I found so fascinating about it was this idea of these two artists meeting, you know, at a young age. And at that age, she was more successful than he was. You know, she was more famous by a long way. And, you know, was really sort of starting to have a proper career as an actor. And then he had this sort of unbelievable overnight success where he stepped in and conducted at Carnegie Hall and became like an overnight sensation. And then obviously there was a huge imbalance. And I thought, what would that be like to be two artists who are in a relationship together, one of whom is basically, you know, a good actress, maybe could have been a great actress. And then one who is this once in a generation, fated everywhere he goes, you know, genius. And what that must have felt like for her.
Yeah. Tell me about where the research began for you once you had signed on.
Well, the first thing that I got from Bradley, because early on I figured, you know, we both realized the dialect was going to be a huge, huge part of it, that needed to feel completely, you know, easy and not something we were reaching for or something that felt like sort of acting. So we had access to these tapes that were, so John Gruen was a writer who went and spent a summer with him in Italy in 67. And he wrote a book called The Private World of Leonard Bernstein. And he interviewed them, all of them, and Shirley Bernstein. And there's also recordings where you can hear the kids. Like, he spent the whole summer interviewing them about every aspect of their lives. And so we've got about 2 45-minute long interviews just with Felicia on her own, that are really insightful, as much for what she says as for what she doesn't say, and the way that she talks about her devotion to Lenny, but also the way that she keeps it all kind of at arm's length in a way that she can walk away from it. You know, she's kind of got the power of the way that she talks about the relationship. So those tapes were fascinating. And then, the family just gave us access to everything, to home videos, to pictures, to we went and rehearsed and shot the film in their home. Mm-hmm. I wore her clothes. They gave me her lighter, her cigarette lighter. And then a couple of months before we started shooting, I decided that I needed to sort of go to Santiago to see where she spent most of her childhood. So I asked Jamie to connect me with any family there. So and they're very close to the family in Chile. So they introduced me to Felicia's nephew, and I went to Chile and met the wider family there, saw the school she went to, you know. So the more we found out, the more we wanted to find out. It was kind of, I feel like we could just, it's a person's life. It's sort of limitless if you have access of what you could learn about that person. So we just did as much as we could.
I'm Chris Murphy.
I'm Richard Lawson.
And I'm Hilary Busis. We are from Vanity Fair's Still Watching podcast. Next up, we're watching the new HBO show, The Regime.
Madam Chancellor, let's keep the gloves on.
This is not a confrontation. We're just saying what's true.
Academy Award winner Kate Winslet is our chancellor as she leads a faux European autocracy in turmoil.
We'll be watching week by week as the regime unravels.
And we'll be talking to the stars along the way.
New episodes of Still Watching will drop every Sunday after the regime airs.
I did an interview with Jamie Bernstein, their daughter, a while back. And, you know, she had said that, you know, they've been protective over their parents' legacy, obviously, but it sounds like they really were excited that their mother would be captured in this as well. Did that add any extra pressure for you, sort of realizing that was so important to them?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think that was what was, you know, what I think when Bradley first said, I want to make a film about your parents, I think they didn't quite even believe it, because, you know, the obvious assumption would be that it would be a biopic of Lenny. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I certainly felt I remember the first time I met them in person, and they already knew that I had the job, but that, you know, and of course Bradley had sort of, you know, run everything past them and talked to him about it. But the first time I actually met them, Bradley and I went and narrated Candide in Philadelphia with the Philadelphia Philharmonic. And on the last performance, they came backstage afterwards. And I remember seeing them coming down the corridor and thinking, well, this is the moment that you're going to meet the person that's playing your mum. And, you know, that the sort of, the trepidation of that. But they were unbelievable, like huge hugs, as if I was already family. And so from then on, I felt, I don't know, I just, they'd always sort of, the way they responded to makeup tests and the way they responded to anything, they were always, they kind of couldn't believe that we were, I think because we were trying really hard, we did so much work to try and understand them and do them justice. I think they appreciated that. So I think as long as we were, you know, showing our workings in how we were getting to these characters, I think it felt all right. And I really wanted more than anything for them to feel that we had done them justice and that I'd done Felicia justice. But I only felt support. I didn't feel like they were kind of testing me ever. They always felt like they were just like part of the team that was backing us to do it.
Yeah. You've played real people before, and it's obviously this balance of never doing imitation, but, you know, getting the character right. When it comes to someone like Felicia, how did you manage that balance? Is there a point where you have to say, okay, I know all I need to know, and now I have to really just step into playing it my way? Or are you always thinking about the real person?
I think in this case, I was always kind of thinking about her, because as it went on, I remember a couple of weeks into shooting, we were doing this stuff where we were shooting the theater scene where she's, you know, talking to him about how he says, if fear's getting in your way. And she said, well, if fear was stopping me, I wouldn't be here. I wouldn't be standing in front of you. And at the time, I'd ordered a bunch of her playbills off eBay and found all her original playbills. So those were arriving in my house, and I was kind of looking over those and looking at the other cast members and thinking about the people that were on stage with her, one of whom she, you know, fell in love with and had a relationship with. It's, you know, not really explored in the film. We do mention him. And I was reading her theatre reviews, you know, a couple of which were nice, a couple of which were a little bit sort of you know, slightly scathing, slightly derogatory, you know. So there was kind of always stuff to feed what we were doing at the time. But yeah, certainly not an imitation. I think I felt kind of we had stuff in common. You know, there were things that I kind of understood about her innately, and I felt very comfortable once I had sort of worked on her voice. I felt very comfortable in her voice. But no, it was kind of a constant, you know, we were still finding things. We were still being sent things. We were still getting, you know, new references the whole way through. So it never really stopped, you know, in terms of the research stuff. That kind of kept on staying part of the process the whole time.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, I can't help but notice that you're an actor. She was an actor. You're married to an artist who is also a musician. What else did you sort of easily relate to her situation?
I think there was a bit of the, well, there were two things. So there was that, you know, she had this sort of proximity to someone who could command a huge amount of people, you know, and I've stood, you know, at the side of stage at Glastonbury and watched Marcus play to 100,000 people, and it is kind of, you know, it's something to see that. And it's quite hard to put yourself, you know, the most I've played to a theatre of about 1,000 people. But, you know, this is 100,000 people singing the words that you've written. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, I can't imagine what that's like. So there was that sort of standing in the wings that I could relate to, and all the feelings that go through your heart and your head when you're watching the person you love, you know, doing that. And there's a great bit in the interview where she's talking to Gru and he says, what do you do backstage at all of these things? And she sort of basically implies that lots of women sort of flutter around trying to get his attention and being annoying. And she says, she basically finds a corner, and then she says, a great deal of waiting, a great deal of smoking. Mm-hmm. And I thought, like, that's familiar, that sense of like, this is the most exciting night of someone's month or year that they're coming to see this show, and you've been on tour for a month and you're over it. And that I was like, oh, I remember what that felt like when I used to go on tour a lot before I had kids. Like, you know, everyone would be like, oh my gosh, it's so exciting, we're backstage at blah, blah, blah. And I'd think, oh, when can we go to bed? lovely, I've seen the show, it's great, I love my husband, but, you know, my goodness me. And so that bit. And then there was another side of her that was really interesting to me in terms of her work as an actor, because she talks in this tape. So John Gruen is a friend as well. And he's saying to her, this is when she's sort of given up her career largely, pretty much completely, to be his wife and to be a mother to their three children. And he says, you know, you really should return to acting. And she sort of tries to brush it off. And he said, but you were so good. But you never gave yourself a chance. And she says, well, I never gave myself a chance. I was always kind of half in, half out. And she talks a lot about how she didn't really ever, you know, she never really kind of went for it. You know, she never kind of, she was really, really critical of the Actors Studio. She thought it was kind of bullshit and kind of ridiculous. And she was much more comfortable with a sort of European approach to theatre. She thought the American approach and all kind of, people writhing around on the floor pretending to be animals, she thought that was sort of ridiculous. And I think probably what she felt really was embarrassed, and that she I think part of her probably would have loved to have been able to do that stuff and be part of that community. But she felt kind of on the outside of it because she wouldn't quite, you know, she had such poise and such reserve. I think there was a part of her that could have really done with just letting go. And when I heard that, I thought, like, that's, I know what that is. You know, I never went to drama school. I didn't get in. But I definitely felt there were times when I sort of have watched other actors sort of really committing to something. And I thought, like, all right, that's a bit, you know, a bit kind of a bit embarrassing. But actually, on some level, I've been thinking, oh, I wish I could do that, because I feel like I'm too English and too embarrassed to actually do all of that stuff, like keeping my dialect in between takes and really kind of. And then on this, Bradley was like, you should know that I want you to do this, but I really want you to go all in. And I remember talking to Kim Gillingham, who's my sort of teacher, and she said, you know, you don't really think of yourself really as an artist. You think of yourself kind of as a farmer, you know, because I live in the countryside and, you know, and then I occasionally go and make films and I come back and I completely shed that thing. And she's like, you are allowed to be an artist. You know, you don't need to be a farmer. And she said, what would happen on Maestro if you actually tried? And she said, you don't try and be a farmer and you just try and be an artist. And so we wrote it down. I wrote it down in my little Felicia book. And I said, what would happen if I actually tried? And then I, from that moment, sort of decided to do all the stuff that I had kind of always been nervous of. And I loved it in the end. And it felt like sort of second skin. It didn't feel weird or embarrassing at all. But there was a real connection with Felicia. I thought, like, I know what that is of being slightly held back and not wanting to sort of let everything go.
Wow, that's really interesting.
So we did have stuff in common.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you feel like you'll do that again, or this has changed how you approach the next thing?
I think so. I mean, it's funny. I did a little job over the summer, like 2 weeks on this little British indie comedy, and did none of that. Like, just waltzed in, had a great time, waltzed off. I just had a baby, so, you know, it was more like a thing I really wanted to do, but it wasn't, you know, I'm very much a supporting in and out thing. So I didn't do any of that work for that film. But I think, yeah, largely that will be the way that I want to. I mean, it's horses for courses, though. It's like, depending on what you're doing. I did like 2 days on Saltburn playing Poor Dear Pamela. I did not do a dream workshop for Poor Dear Pamela. I very much invested in the hair and makeup fittings, but I didn't, you know, I didn't go and research Poor Dear Pamela's backstory. But I think, yeah, probably on the whole, that would be the way that I'd like to work going forward.
Well, you mentioned the dream workshops, and I wanted to hear a little bit more about how you and Bradley created the bond between these two characters, because it sounds like there was a lot of time spent to make sure that you got that right. Yeah. I don't even know what a dream workshop is, but tell me about it.
Neither did I, really. But actually, my teacher, Kim, does, you know, she's trained. This is what she's sort of trained in. So it's essentially sort of, you basically record your dreams. You wake up in the morning or in the middle of the night, whenever, and you try and write down your dreams. And then you bring them in to the workshop. And it was just me and Bradley and Kim. And then you sort of tell each other, describe them. And then as you're describing them, you sometimes assign a kind of gesture to one of the things or feelings that happens. It's essentially trying to figure out why your subconscious is bringing that dream to you, and does it connect to the work that you're doing on screen? The whole thing, the long, it sounds so hippie, but the long and short of it is that you're basically trying to connect your subconscious to the material, to the script, the character, so that when you get on set, lots of things just happen without you having to think about them. So lots of sort of the things that just are, you two are connected in some way. And then in the process, there's a lot of soul bearing and a lot of crying. And as you can imagine, and it just makes you closer. You know, if you just sit around crying with someone for a week, it's, you know, it's, and then at the end of the week, you do a kind of, you put on this like mini sort of performance art thing where you know, usually to music, you kind of come up with a little kind of sort of mini 20 minute kind of show thing that kind of connects everything that you've thought about that week. Within that week, that sort of thing of us sitting back to back, that was where that started. So that, in the middle of one of the workshops one day, Kim said something, she wanted us to talk about something. She was like, why don't you just sit? It might be easier to sit back to back than look at each other. So we sat back to back, and then when it came to filming, Bradley wrote it in so that we could, because it was just such a kind of brilliant metaphor for their relationship, that one of them would lean heavier on the other at different parts of their lives. And so yeah, it was like that. I've never done it before. And I was absolutely terrified to do it because I thought it sounded mad, particularly the last bit where you have to create this little bit of performance art. But it was amazing. And if nothing else, although I do think it gave us a huge amount, by the time we had done it, we were like unbelievably close. And that, I think, just went straight into the film.
But you're saying this is not going to be on the DVD extras?
Sadly not. No cameras allowed. There's no record of that time. But that was the coolest thing as well, that it was like, you know, it wasn't other, we took a whole week in the pre-production schedule, just Bradley did nothing but this, you know, he had so much, all his directing prep and writing and all that kind of producing stuff. And he just stopped all of that. And we just did just Lenny and Felicia for a full week for 8 hours a day for 6 days. And I think it just all went into the film.
And, you know, obviously a part of this story is their unconventional marriage. And how did you sort of come to grips with, you know, the choice Felicia made to be aware of the fact that he had other, you know, loves and interests outside of their marriage.
I mean, I think she was crystal clear from the beginning with it. And I think from when they had met, they just felt like there was sort of inevitability that they would be together. I mean, you can read her letter. There's an amazing book, actually, of all of his letters, so all of his correspondence. Lots of letters to him, and maybe not as many that he's written back, so maybe they couldn't get a hold of. But there's a, you know, huge big book of letters, and in that, lots of letters from Felicia and vice versa, from him back to her. And in one of these letters before they get married, she says, "You are a homosexual and may never change, but I believe, you know, something along the lines of, we can make a marriage without me sacrificing myself as a martyr on the altar of LB." So she was very clear, like this was, she knew what she was signing herself up for. And in the letter, sort of a sense that should he have to limit himself from not having these relationships with men, that would be kind of fundamentally altering his character, or his, you know, his sort of joie de vivre would be kind of dampened by not being, and she wanted him to be fully himself.
Yeah.
So that side of it was clear. And you know, I think in that time, when she was that age, absolutely, she believed wholeheartedly that she could manage that. And I think just as time went on, that became more difficult. But I think that the fundamentally, it wasn't really about sex or infidelity, you know, that they sort of split. I think it was that, you know, she had been, throughout all of it, his, you know, muse, mentor, lover, best friend, confidant, the one that he went to when he was terrified, the one that he would look to in the wings. He'd come off, he'd go straight to her, and then he'd come back on stage. And that was sort of, you know, we see it in the film over and over again, but that, you know, she was that person to him. And there can only be one of that person. There can't be, even if you have a manager or an agent or whatever, like there's only one person like that. And she was that. And then she wasn't. And I think it was that betrayal that, you know, it could sleep with whoever, but it was about this place being usurped by somebody else.
Yeah. So when you signed on, A Star Is Born had not come out.
No.
Is that right? So Bradley Cooper, the director, had not come out, I guess, is what I would say.
Yeah.
How would you sort of describe him in that role as a director?
Oh, man. I mean, yeah, I've never had an experience like it. I mean, it's... I think he definitely said it to Matt Bowman, because Matt's been talking about it. And I feel like he said something along the same lines to me. He said, if you do this film, you'll never feel yourself acting. And Matt and I were both like, what?
okay.
But you know, I understand what he means, you know, because he created an environment where there was, a lot of it felt like theatre. A lot of it felt like, and there was never that. What he would do a lot was, well, first of all, I would come on set and he would be Lenny already. So he'd get ready. He'd be Lenny by the time crew call started.
Okay.
So he'd come in at 2 a.m, 3 a.m, depending on how long his makeup was. So by the time I got there, he was all ready, fully looked like Lenny. He was in the dialect. He was chain smoking, you know. So I never really sort of, I hardly saw him as Bradley through the whole thing. But also every scene would start with improvisation. That very rarely would we start with the actual lines of dialogue that were in a script, so that it wasn't that thing of sort of, and there was no sort of big, loud kind of calling action. It was all like you just sort of walked on set and it sort of started shooting. So there wasn't a lot of that kind of film structural kind of noise that makes actors kind of slightly shrink into themselves and become. So it just felt like you walked on set and suddenly someone was talking to you and you were talking to them. And then maybe a couple of minutes later, you'd be saying something that was in the script and then you would carry on with it. So in that sense, I think he was right that he did make it that. Yeah. And you could, he wanted ideas. He wanted people to bring stuff in. Like the first scene of us in Tanglewood where we're sitting back to back and that big crane shot comes in and finds us on the floor right before we did that. He said, we're going to be sitting back to back and I want you to think of a game. And so I thought of this game that I played with my brother when we were kids, where we would try and have a psychic connection. We would look at each other in the eyes and, you know, I'd be like, I'm sending you a number between 1 and 20, 1 and 10, whatever. And then he would sort of try and like get it from me and we'd have to sort of build up a strong connection to do it. So we played that game and that was, you know, we just improvised that and that was you know, what he, and then we did that and he was like, done, moving on. You know, so he knew the essence of what he always wanted, whether it was scripted or like improv here and there. And it did feel like, you know, we shot the Dakota scene, big party. We had two cameras going and everyone was talking the whole way through. So he was talking to Shirley, I was talking to Mendy and Cynthia. There was no concerns about overlap. We just, you know, and so these scenes would run concurrently and then he would cut and then he'd come in and ask me how it went. And, you know, so it was just a sense of things were being captured without us having to sort of perform in a kind of conventional sense. And that, I think, is what made it feel kind of live. And so, yeah, I mean, I've never seen anything like it. It was an amazing way to work.
Oh, interesting. And there was some sound mixer crying in the corner during
the party.
Well,
the sound mixer being a genius, because this was all kind of condoned, which, you know, because usually there's any kind of overlap, you get immediately scolded, or someone comes and says, "Can you do one where you don't?" And you think, "Oh." But this time, Steve had figured it out; like he knew how to do it. I mean, I did no ADR for this film. Oh, wow. I did probably a couple of lines on my iPhone in the cupboard. Like Bradley would be like, "Can you record this and just send it to me?" And I'd go into the cupboard and lock myself away from my children and record it on my iPhone 5 different ways and send it to him. And that was what was in the film. But I never went into a studio to do ADR. So all the whatever Steve did, some sort of genius. It was, yeah, amazing.
And we're almost out of time, but I wanted to end on what you think Felicia might have thought of this. Her kids have said she was obviously the more private of the two and you know, harder to know, but do you ever think about what she might think about her story being out there now?
Yeah, I mean, I wrote to her before it started because I felt just a nice, polite thing to do. So I wrote her a little letter saying, like, you know, I hope this is all right. And, you know, and I'm not particularly sort of, well, I don't know, but I wrote it. And I just said, I hope this is all right and that we really love your family and we want to, you know, and we really love you and want to make a sort of tribute to you guys and to your family. And I think it is that. I mean, I think the biggest sense that I have from it is the sense of sort of family and love. You know, there was lots of tragedy and there was lots of sadness and lots of hardship, but there was, I think that was far outweighed by joy and kind of beauty. And I think that it is a film about artists. And the beauty of artistry and how we can bring that out in one another. And so I think she would have, I hope she would have been happy.
That does it for today's show. We'll be back on Thursday with a roundtable conversation. And then we will have another interview episode next Tuesday, December 26th, and then take a little bit of time off before the new year starts. Find us in the meantime at vanityfair.com. Email us at littlegoldmen@vf.com. We would love to have all your emails waiting for us after the break. Find us on social media at VF Awards Insider. And on our own, I am at Katie Rich and David.
David Canfield 97.
And Rebecca.
Becca M. Ford.
Our editor and producer, as always, is Brett Fuchs.
I'm Bobby Finger.
And I'm Lindsay Weber.
Do you ever see a new face or name on your news feeds and say, "Who the heck is that?"
Our podcast, Who Weekly, is everything you need to know about the celebrities you don't. Think of us as your cheat code to People Magazine, your glossary for Hollywood, a shortcut to understanding pop culture at large.
For the past 8 years, Who Weekly has been telling listeners everything they need to know about the celebrities they don't. The New Yorker says we spelunk deep into the demimonde with convivial delight. That's a direct quote.
Mostly, we're going to explain to you Irish star Barry Keoghan's sudden rise to fame and relationship with a not-so-under-the-radar pop princess named Sabrina.
The fake wedding Real Housewives star Cynthia Bailey had to promote a limo rental company.
And why all the Gen Zers you know are talking about a guy named Benson Boone.
Each episode goes deep into the biggest celebrity stories of the moment. And if you're still confused, we even have a weekly call-in episode where we answer the most burning celebrity queries.
Who Weekly airs twice weekly with brand new episodes on Tuesdays and Fridays. Listen and follow Who Weekly, an Odyssey podcast, available now for free on the Odyssey app and wherever you get your podcasts.
From PRX.